From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Invece siamo stati coperti da una pioggia di fuoco, una cosa assolutamente.
But then suddenly, we found ourselves under an immense amount of bullets, something terrible. Without any warning, and we realized that nearby there was an American tank which was shooting at us.
Che ci stava sparando addosso.
Italian journalist Giuliana Sgrena is released from a Rome military hospital as new details emerge on what happened when U.S. soldiers opened fire on her car as it took her to freedom. We'll be joined by Naomi Klein, who just met with Sgrena in Rome.
I met with kidnapped Italian journalist Giuliana Sgrena, whose car was fired on by U.S. troops on her way to the airport. She told me some shocking details about the incident that may explain why the U.S. military is refusing to cooperate with the investigation.
There has been another government brought down in a former Soviet state. We'll look at the revolt in Kyrgyzstan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. There's been a large car bombing near the Iraqi city of Ramadi, killing at least 11 Iraqi policemen, wounding 14 other people, including two U.S. Army soldiers. Meanwhile, five Iraqi women, four of whom worked for the U.S. military, were found shot to death in a bullet-ridden car in western Baghdad. It's believed the women worked as translators for the U.S. Army. A day after Iraqi commanders claimed a joint operation with U.S. forces killed more than 80 resistance fighters at a training camp outside of Baghdad, reporters who visited the camp are contradicting that claim. Journalists from Agence France-Presse and other agencies say they saw 30 to 40 fighters at the lakeside training camp attacked by U.S. and Iraqi forces the day before, claiming they'd never left. One of the fighters said only 11 resistance fighters were killed in airstrikes on the site. Local hospitals told AFP they had received no casualties from the battle. Meanwhile, on the political front, Shiite political leaders say the new parliament could convene for the second time ever early next week to nominate its speaker and the country's president. The Shiite parties are expected to take 16 to 17 ministries in the new government. Meanwhile, a new group of prominent Iraqi lawyers said at a conference in Baghdad this week, President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair should be tried as war criminals for the occupation of Iraq, highlighting the massive assaults on the city of Fallujah. They echoed earlier claims by an official from the U.S.-backed Iraqi Health Ministry, who charged that the U.S. had used banned weapons against Fallujah. The lawyers called for establishing a truth commission to investigate U.S. crimes in Iraq and demand an end to what they call immunity for U.S. occupation forces. In Rome, journalist Giuliana Sgrena has been released from a military hospital where she was being treated for a gunshot wound she suffered when U.S. forces shot up the car, bringing her to freedom after a month being held hostage in Iraq. The head of Italy's foreign military intelligence, Nicola Calipari, was killed in the attack when he shielded Sgrena from the bullets. Yesterday, Italian newspapers reported the justice minister had asked U.S. authorities to release the car so it can be examined by Italian ballistics experts. The paper said the request came after the U.S. command in Iraq reportedly blocked two Italian policemen from examining the car. In a moment, we'll be joined by journalist Naomi Klein, who just met with Giuliana Sgrena in Rome. Now to the Terri Schiavo case. As she begins her seventh day without food or water, her parents are running out of legal options. A U.S. district court judge is now deliberating the parents' latest plea. The same federal judge earlier this week refused to order Schiavo's feeding tube reinserted. A four-hour hearing before the judge ended late Thursday with no ruling announced. Anti-abortion activist Randall Terri, who's acting as a spokesperson for Schiavo's parents, said their new motion raises evidentiary issues that were ignored in the first crack at federal court. But legal experts say it's unlikely to succeed. The U.S. Supreme Court declined yesterday to hear the case. The High Court did not explain its decision to turn aside the case, just as it had declined to do in four previous appeals. None of the justices registered a dissent. That action was followed by rulings Thursday from a Pinellas County Circuit judge who barred the state from trying to take custody of Schiavo and reaffirmed she would not want to be kept alive through artificial means. Schiavo's condition deteriorated visibly 7 days after her feeding tube was removed by court order, and death could come at any time. Meanwhile, in Bush's home state of Texas, a columnist for the Star-Telegram newspaper has revealed that as governor, Bush's position on cases like Terry Schiavo's was diametrically opposed to the one he's now advocating. As governor, George Bush signed a Texas law in 99 that allows a person's next of kin to make decisions regarding life support for patients whose conditions have been judged hopeless by a physician and a hospital's bioethics committee. The column by Bob Ray Sanders is called Bush Willing to Err on the Side of Death in Texas. It says there are 152 reasons why President Bush's statements and actions regarding the Terry Schiavo case don't make sense. That's the number of people executed in Texas during Bush's tenure as governor. President Bush's approval rating has fallen to 45%, the lowest point of his presidency. This according to a new USA Today CNN Gallup poll. It found the largest drop for President Bush came among men, self-described conservatives and churchgoers. Independent political analysts said the drop may reflect opposition to the White House and Congress intervening in the Terry Schiavo matter. A USA Today CNN Gallup poll last weekend found that 61% would have a spouse's feeding tube removed under similar circumstances. This news on the genocide in Sudan. The UN Security Council has voted unanimously to authorize a 10,000-strong peacekeeping force for the south of the country. The official mission of the peacekeepers will be to monitor the agreement signed between the government and southern rebels. Here is the UN Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping, Jean-Marie Guéhenno.
It is clear that the present state of affairs in Darfur is unacceptable. Its problems are immediate, and we cannot accept the status quo. The violence and destruction must stop.
The UN estimates it could take months before the force is deployed. U.S. war resister Jeremy Hinsman lost his bid yesterday for political asylum in Canada after the country's Immigration and Refugee Board said it was unconvinced he faces persecution if he returns home to the United States. Hinsman drew international attention after he deserted the 82nd Airborne Division in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, 14 months ago and fled to Toronto just days before his unit was deployed to Iraq. At his three-day refugee hearing in December, he contended if he killed or injured someone in Iraq, his actions would amount to atrocities because the conflict was illegal and hence criminal. His case now goes to a Canadian court.
Kim and John Army, 'cause you had no place to go. 'Cause ain't nobody hiring here since I'm jousing down to Mexico. Reckon that learning self-trade made me see the world. Moved to the city someday, married a black-haired girl. Somebody somewhere had another plan. Now he's got a rival in his hand. Rolling in a bag and wondering how he got this far. Another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war. Bobby had an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue to the moon when landing Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still there chasing ghosts.
Steve Earle, Rich Man's War, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. In Rome, journalist Giuliana Segrena has been released from a military hospital where she was being treated for a gunshot wound she suffered when U.S. forces shot up the car, bringing her to freedom after a month being held hostage in Iraq. The head of Italy's foreign military intelligence, Nicola Calipari, was killed in the attack when he shielded Segrena from the bullets.
On Thursday, Italian newspapers reported the justice minister has asked U.S. authorities to release the car so it can be examined by Italian ballistics experts. The papers say the request came after the U.S. command in Iraq reportedly blocked two Italian policemen from examining the car. We're joined now in Washington, D.C. by journalist Naomi Klein, who's just met with Giuliana Sgrena in Rome. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Naomi.
Thanks, Amy.
Can you talk about what she told you?
Yeah, at first I want to say that I know Giuliana really would have liked to have been on the show herself to talk to your listeners and viewers. But one of the things that surprised me when I met with Giuliana is that she's quite a bit sicker than I think we've been led to believe. Her injuries were described as fairly minor. She was shot in the shoulder. But when I met with her, she was clearly very, very ill, and that's why she's not on the show this morning. She was fired on by a gun at the top of a tank, which means that the artillery was very, very large. It was a 4-inch bullet that entered her body and broke apart. And it didn't just injure her shoulder, it punctured her lung. And her lung continues to fill with fluid, and there continues to be complications stemming from that fairly serious injury. So that was one of the details. She told me a lot about the incident that I hadn't fully understood from the reports in the press. One of the most, the other thing I want to be really clear about is that Giuliana is not saying that she's certain in any way that the attack on the car was intentional. She is simply saying that she has many, many unanswered questions, and there are many parts of her direct experience that simply don't coincide with the official U.S. version of the story. One of the things that we keep hearing is that she was fired on the road to the airport, which is a notoriously dangerous road. In fact, it's often described as the most dangerous road in the world. So this is treated as a fairly common and understandable incident that there would be a shooting like this on that road. And I was on that road myself, and it is a really treacherous place with explosions going off all the time and a lot of checkpoints. What Giuliana told me that I hadn't realized before is that she wasn't on that road at all. She was on a completely different road that I actually didn't know existed. It's a secured road that you can only enter through the green zone and is reserved exclusively for ambassadors and top military officials. So when Calipari, the Italian security intelligence officer, released her from captivity, they drove directly to the green zone, went through the elaborate checkpoint process, which everyone must go through to enter the green zone, which involves checking in, obviously, with U.S. forces. And then they drove onto this secured road. And the other thing that Giuliana told me that she's quite frustrated about is the description of the vehicle that fired on her as being part of a checkpoint. She says it wasn't a checkpoint at all. It was simply a tank that was parked on the side of the road that opened fire on them. There was no process of trying to stop the car, she said, or any signals. She's from her perspective, it was just an opening fire by a tank. The other thing she told me that was surprising to me was that they were fired on from behind, because I think part of what we're hearing is that the U.S. soldiers opened fire on their car because they didn't know who they were and they were afraid. It was self-defense. They were afraid. The fear, of course, is that their car might blow up or that they might come under attack themselves. And what Giuliana Sgrena really stressed with me was that the bullet that injured her so badly and that killed Calipari came from behind, entered the back seat of the car. And the only person who was not severely injured in the car was the driver. And she said that this is because the shots weren't coming from the front or even from the side. They were coming from behind, i.e. they were driving away. So the idea that this was an act of self-defense, I think, becomes much more questionable. And that detail may explain why there's some reticence to give up the vehicle for inspection, because if indeed the majority of the gunfire is coming from behind, then clearly they were firing at a car that was driving away from them.
Now, can you talk about when Nicola Calipari arrived in Baghdad? And for people who haven't been following this story so much, the U.S. version of events of them driving to the airport very fast on a road with many checkpoints, as you pointed out, not the secured road, that the U.S. soldiers fired into the air, tried to stop the vehicle, that they just kept on coming, and so eventually they shot at them. Can you you talk about how the Italian military intelligence official first came to Iraq?
My understanding is he came the day before, and that he had checked in. U.S. authorities were aware of his presence. There was some kind of a negotiation process, but these details actually haven't come to light. The details that led to the negotiation, if there was a ransom paid, we don't know those details yet. What Giuliana knows is simply what happened from the moment of her release to this day, and her description is that she didn't see any of those signals, and she really wants people to know that she was not on a road with any checkpoints. And in fact, she told me many times that Iraqis are not in any way able to access this road. It's not the road that we hear described so many times as being a road with roadside bombs going off all the time, with checkpoints that you have to pass through. It's a completely separate road, actually a Saddam-era road, it would seem, that allowed his vehicles to pass directly from the airport to his palace. And now that is the U.S. military base at the airport directly to the U.S.-controlled Green Zone and the U.S. Embassy.
And Naomi, what did she tell you about Calipari? Was he was sitting in the back in the car with her in the back, or what happened when the shooting began and with him?
Yes, I mean, she feels a tremendous amount of guilt, as you can imagine. And one of the reasons why she feels so much guilt is that Calipari chose to sit with her in the back seat. There were only three of them in the vehicle, so he could have sat in the front seat with the driver. But because she was so afraid and she had just emerged from this horrifying ordeal of being in captivity for a month, he told Giuliana, "Let's sit together in the back seat, and I'll tell you." She said that he was telling her stories to try to reconnect her with her life, because she had been incredibly disoriented. One of the things she told me that was most disorienting about her month in captivity was she didn't know what the difference between day and night. She didn't have control over the light switches, and because of Baghdad's constant blackouts, the lights would go on and off at all hours, and she couldn't control the switches, so she really didn't know where she was. She says she has kind of a black hole of that month, and she said one of the most terrifying things was that she would often hear U.S. helicopters over the house, and she was obviously very afraid that the house that she was in would come under fire, because obviously it was a resistance house, it was a resistance stronghold, and she had many reasons to fear. She was afraid of her captors, she was afraid of U.S. soldiers. And so Calipari sat with her in the back seat, and he just told her stories about all of her friends, about her husband, about everyone who'd been worried about her, about Italy. And that was the context in which he was killed. So it was his decision to sit with her in the back seat, and he was telling her these stories and reconnecting her with her past life, with her current life, when he died, protecting her from a bullet. And she told me that moment is really all she's able to remember vividly. That's the only moment that feels real to her, is the moment of his death. In fact, her month in captivity, horrific as it was, she said, feels like a faraway dream. All she can think about is the moment where he died, really in her arms, protecting her.
And what about the driver of the car? What did she tell you anything about what happened with him, or did she recall that part?
Well, what she told me, and this is an incident that I know has been reported on in the Italian press, but not so much in the American press, is that after the shooting, she was very injured. They took her out of the car, lay her down. I think I don't know if they had a stretcher, but she was being tended to. Her wounds were being tended to, and the driver, who was another intelligence officer, called Italy and was on the phone, I think, with Berlusconi. She said, and he said, "Our car has just been fired on by 300 to 400 bullets." And as he was saying this, the U.S. soldiers ordered him to hang up the phone. So, but I asked her whether she'd had connected with him since the incident, and she said that she hadn't, with the driver.
We're talking to Naomi Klein, independent journalist, who just met with Giuliana Sgrena, saw her in her hospital room in Rome. I'm looking at Jeremy Scahill's piece in the most recent Independent called Checkpoint Killings Unchecked that says the Italian government, a close ally of the Bush administration, is disputing what the U.S. says. According to Italy's foreign minister, Calapri arrived in Baghdad that Friday after making contact with the kidnappers. Calapri and a fellow agent checked in with U.S. authorities at the airport as well as the forces patrolling the area. The agents had been given security badges by the U.S. to allow them to travel freely in the country. After picking up Sgrena from the abandoned vehicle where her kidnappers left her, they drove slowly to the airport, keeping the car lights on to help identify themselves at U.S. checkpoints. It says news of Sgrena's release was already on the Reuters newswire and on Al Jazeera. The mood in the car was one of celebration until the vehicle came under intense gunfire. So this is also not only what you and Giuliana Sgrena are saying, but quite something that one of Bush's closest allies to the top, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, is now refuting his allies' claims and also demanding an investigation that the U.S. is stopping at this point. Naomi.
Well, Berlusconi is facing elections at the beginning of April, which is partially why he needs to be seen to be taking somewhat of a tough line with the U.S. He isn't facing presidential elections. That doesn't come for another, I think, till 2007. But there are regional elections, and this was a national, obviously a national incident, and he needed to be seen to be standing up to the U.S. in some way. But he's really been going back and forth, and this is another thing that Giuliana Sgrena was very frustrated about because as we know, she is very, very opposed and continues to be strongly opposed to the ongoing occupation of Iraq, believes that Italian and indeed all foreign troops should withdraw. And in the face, and one thing she told me that was very moving was she believes that her release really came as a result of anti-war organizing in Italy across incredible coalitions. And she said that she feels like her life is a testament to what people can do when they get organized and when they work together. And she's frustrated that that same pressure forced Berlusconi to announce that Italian troops would be withdrawn in September, and she really felt that the left opposition parties should have really maintained pressure on Berlusconi to insist on Italian troop withdrawal now. But in fact, Berlusconi has been allowed to backpedal on this claim, and now he's saying he didn't really say that. They'll withdraw when Iraqi security forces are strong enough. And of course, Iraqi security forces it's not a training problem. It's an occupation problem. The reason why Iraqi security forces aren't strong enough is because they're being massacred because they are seen as an extension of the occupation. They don't have any independence, and the continued occupation is the greatest problem to Iraqi security independence. It's not helping.
Naomi, we have to break. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion and also talk about Paul Wolfowitz to be president of the World Bank. We'll then come back here in New York to talk about the situation in Kyrgyzstan and also speak with a student who is part of the group that won a tremendous victory at Georgetown University. They fasted for workers at the university to get a living wage, and they won. Stay with us. Yearning by Rahim Alhaj here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue with independent reporter Naomi Klein. She just met with Juliana Skrena, who has just been released from a Rome hospital to her home, though she is still very ill, dealing with having been shot on the way to the airport after her release by in Iraqi captivity. Naomi Klein, the news that the checkpoint the road that they were Calipari was killed on, that she was driving on, Skrena, when she was being driven to the airport, had been set up for that. There had been a checkpoint set up for the trip of U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte to a dinner that night with General George Casey, commander of U.S. forces in Iraq. To provide security, U.S. soldiers established mobile checkpoints, clusters of Humvees armed with 50-caliber machine guns on top. It was one of the details that opened fire on the Italian's vehicle. Have you heard anything about this?
Well, this would support what Juliana told me, which is that the road she was on was not the public road that other journalists have traveled on, and that contractors and so on travel on, the very dangerous road. It was a secured road reserved for top embassy officials, like Negroponte. But one thing that's very clear is that, you know, if she's on this road and the way she explains it, she had to go through a U.S. checkpoint in order to get into the green zone. You can only access this road through the green zone. It's very, very difficult to get into the green zone. When I tried to get into the green zone, I had to go through six different passport checks. So the idea that the American military didn't know that they were on the road, that didn't know about their presence, is impossible if she was in fact on a road that emerged out of the green zone. And I think that the idea that there was a mobile checkpoint set up for Negroponte obviously supports this claim very strongly. What Juliana was talking about was the only thing she could figure out is that the people who they checked in with in the green zone, the U.S. soldiers they checked in with in the green zone in order to get in, didn't radio ahead to these mobile checkpoints and warn them that they were coming. And from her perspective, that could have either been a mistake or it could have been some sort of act of vengeance and anger, you know, and we know that there's a lot of anger at the idea that Italians may be paying very large ransoms for the release of prisoners. She's not alleging some grand conspiracy. There could have just been broken down communication. But the idea that they didn't know, I think, is impossible if she was on the secured road, because it emerged out of the green zone, and can't get into the green zone without passing through a checkpoint.
But even if there was broken down communication, it would seem that the issue of even just firing on a car that is moving away from you and is posing no threat to you on this secured road certainly raises questions of at least extreme negligence on the part of the U.S. soldiers.
I think so, and I think. That all of these details will obviously emerge from the investigation, and we'll be hearing it directly from Juliana herself. Presumably from the driver.
Did Juliana talk about her time in captivity and who held her, Naomi Klein?
Yeah, she did. I mean, she talked about this incredible disorientation. I know that you've covered the case on your show, and you've really stressed the fact that Juliana's experience is not at all unique from the perspective of Iraqis who are living in this sort of pincer of the fear of being caught in a bombing by the resistance, or a fear of being shot by U.S. soldiers at a checkpoint. And this is an ongoing fear every time Iraqis leave their home. And we're only hearing about this because there was a foreigner involved, because it was such a dramatic incident. But I think the other part of the story is the implications for journalists and for independent journalists, because Juliana Skrena is really a hero, and she is an incredibly committed war correspondent who has put herself in situations of tremendous risk around the world. She's been to Iraq many, many times, and she went back to Iraq after Simone Pari and Simone Toretta had been kidnapped and released. She told me that she's met with the Simonas in her hospital room, as well as several other people who've been kidnapped. She referred to it as the ex-kidnapped club. And she went to knowing these risks, but one thing she told me that I think is an issue that you've discussed often on this show is the implications of for all of this, for whether independent journalists can do their job in Iraq. And coming from someone who has been willing to take such tremendous risks, she said she just can't figure out how it's possible at this point. And this is because the people who held her made it very clear to her that they don't want independent journalists working in Iraq, talking to Iraqis. This was really one of the most disturbing details, and I think a very telling detail. And she told them that made them just like Bush, because the Bush administration has also made it clear that they don't want independent witnesses talking to Iraqis, counting the bodies, highlighting the civilian toll of the war. But there are also clearly some elements of the resistance that feel the same way. And this makes it very, very difficult for independent journalists to do their work.
We're talking to independent reporter Naomi Klein, who's just returned from Rome, where she met with Giuliana Sgrena in her hospital room. You came to the United States from Canada now for the 40th anniversary of the Vietnam teach-ins and spoke last night in Washington. One of the things you talked about, Naomi, was the nomination of Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Defense Secretary, to become president of the World Bank. Can you talk about the significance of this appointment?
Well, I think it's tremendously significant in the sense that the World Bank is something of a contested institution. There are very real power struggles within the World Bank, really between people who do genuinely believe that the World Bank should be an institution devoted to aid to poverty, to direct poverty alleviation programs, AIDS treatment, sanitation, other healthcare programs, education, and then the ideologues, the people who still adhere to what's called the Washington Consensus, the idea that the way you deal with poverty and the way you encourage development is by forcing poor countries to adopt very radical free market policies, the centerpiece of which is privatization of basic services like water, electricity, and essentially the role of the World Bank is to loan countries money, fund mega projects that will attract multinational corporations, and then the development, the aid, will happen in the trickle down. And I think the significance of Wolfowitz's appointment is that within the World Bank, the ideologues were really losing because the so-called Washington Consensus or neoliberal economics it has really been in crisis, particularly in Latin America, where you have a continent-wide rejection of the policies of privatization and deregulation. You have left governments being elected across the continent. You have neoliberal governments being thrown out, escaping in helicopters in Bolivia, Argentina, and a real move towards rethinking the logic of these policies, precisely because they created tremendous wealth, tremendous growth for the past 15 years, but that did not translate into poverty alleviation. In fact, you have in Latin America many more people living in poverty. So the appointment of Wolfowitz in this context is a very clear message from the Bush administration. They're sending in one of their top ideologues, somebody who is a true believer in the so-called Washington Consensus, and we know this because Wolfowitz was, of course, the architect of the post-war plan, such as it was in Iraq, which was itself a radical experiment in precisely these policies. Wolfowitz oversaw the move to privatize Iraq's entire economy, to fire 500,000 state employees, based on this same thinking, that if Iraq becomes a sort of utopia for foreign corporations, then everything else will be solved in the trickle-down. And, of course, in fact, what happened in Iraq is these radical economic policies led to the feeding of the armed resistance. Many people who were laid off by Paul Bremer under Paul Wolfowitz's supervision joined the armed resistance.
Naomi Klein, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Independent reporter speaking to us from Washington, D.C. We are also going to post on our website Jeremy Scahill's piece in The Independent called Checkpoint Killings Unchecked. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, as we broadcast on over 330 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, as well as on both satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as DirecTV, Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org in our closed caption for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. So we turn now to another leading story of the day. Juan?
Well, yesterday, opposition protesters in Kyrgyzstan took over the presidential compound and other government buildings, effectively bringing President Askar Akayev's government to collapse. This is the third government in a former Soviet republic to fall due to popular uprisings. In the past year and a half, Georgia and most recently Ukraine also ousted their leaders in popular uprisings.
Askar Akayev had led Kyrgyzstan since 1990, before it gained independence from the Soviet Union. The takeover began on Thursday morning in the outskirts of the capital, Bishkek. The Associated Press reported about 1,000 protesters rushed towards the presidential building, entered the front, and smashed windows with stones. Akayev's whereabouts are currently unknown, though there's speculation he may have sought sanctuary in the Russian air base outside the capital. Both the U.S. and Russia have military air bases near Bishkek, and about 1,000 U.S. troops are stationed there. This is U.S. State Department spokesman Adam Irali.
Obviously, we're following events in Bishkek and Kyrgyzstan closely. I can't confirm for you specific movements. We're following reports closely, but I don't have any confirmation of the whereabouts of the president or his entourage. What I can tell you is that we are working with our friends in the UN, in the OSCE, and in the international community to urge both government officials and protesters both to refrain from violence and to engage in constructive dialogue. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe envoy, Mr. Betterly, is meeting with opposition figures in Bishkek, our ambassador, in coordination with the OSCE and others, plans to meet opposition figures, including Mr. Bakiyev and Mr. Kulov. We've been in contact with our Russian friends and Kyrgyzstan's Central Asian neighbors to make sure we're all in sync on the need for a peaceful solution. I would say our overall approach to the situation is to support the efforts of the Kyrgyz people to build a stable and prosperous democracy, and to work with the other members of the international community to achieve a peaceful solution to the current situation.
State Department spokesperson Adam Irali. We're turning now to Robert Templer, who's director of the Asia Program for the International Crisis Group, who joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you explain the situation in Kyrgyzstan?
Well, I think for some time now, the opposition has been gathering steam, in, partially to do with the levels of corruption, the mismanagement of this country, and the degree to which Akayev has really tried to strangle any sort of political dissent or political opposition to him. He rigged the recent parliamentary elections, and that's caused an explosion of anger, which has boiled up into this popular uprising, and we've seen the results yesterday.
Now, this is largely a Muslim country, isn't it? What's been the impact, obviously, of the growing unrest in other sections of the Muslim world within Kyrgyzstan?
Well, it is a Muslim country, but it's a very secularized country on the whole. There is some links to Islamic groups in the south of the country, particularly a group called Hizb ut-Tahrir, which is a fairly extremist organization, although a non-violent organization. But most of the country is relatively moderate. The long period of Soviet rule obviously had a major impact on Islam in this region. But also, Kyrgyz are nomadic people. They don't tend to be particularly strong Muslims. They're not particularly dogmatic Muslims. So Islam hasn't played a critical role in this, but there's definitely an effort by Islamic groups in the south to try and take advantage of some of the situations going on now.
Can you describe the situation in the capital? I mean, this is now a country without a government.
Well, there was still some looting going on today. I spoke to people in our office in Bishkek, and they said that there were some police out on the streets, but they weren't doing very much to stop looting. A lot of the big stores, a lot of which were owned by the Akayev family, have been completely stripped of all their goods. A lot of things are shut up, but people are sort of wandering around the streets. It's a very mixed atmosphere. On some levels, there's some tension. On other levels, it seems to be returning to normality in some ways.
Now, wasn't Akayev, when he first came to power, seen basically as a supporter of the liberalization or reforms that followed the collapse of the Soviet Union? Or what happened in the trajectory of his rule?
Well, he became increasingly hardline over the years. He did start off as a reformer. The early years were fairly democratic. And in fact, he was simply much better than any of the other leaders in Central Asia. In some ways, this is it's a good thing that he's gone, but it would be much better to have gotten rid of a number of other dictators in that region. He started off fairly moderate. He moved to a more hardline position. He was encouraged in this to a certain degree by the Russians in recent years. He was encouraged by his fellow dictators across Central Asia to move to a more hardline position. But Kyrgyzstan never really had the state structures to impose the sort of really intense police state that exists in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. It simply never had the capacity to do that. There was always an opposition. There was always an active NGO community. There have always been very effective politicians there who stood in opposition to him. So he was never able to control things in the way that other Central Asian leaders have.
Robert Templer is with the International Crisis Group. We have to break. When we come back, I want to ask you about the U.S. and Russian vying for power in Kyrgyzstan. You've written also about neighboring Uzbekistan and about how the U.S. has supported the ruler there despite tremendous human rights abuses. And what about the role in Kyrgyzstan? That's coming up here on Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Robert Templer is our guest, director of the Asia Program for the International Crisis Group in our studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, I'd like to ask you, both the United States and Russia have military bases in Kyrgyzstan. That must be one of the few countries in the world that have bases by both of these military powers.
I think it's probably the only one. There's been a lot of competition between the two countries to a certain degree over Akayev and access to these bases. And Akayev in recent years has tended towards the Russian side. The Russians are very much viewing this as an illegal overthrow, something that was outside of constitutional rule in Kyrgyzstan, and they're certainly going to blame it very much on U.S. interference, although I've spent the past 4 years trying to get people in D.C. to be interested in Kyrgyzstan, and you know there are maybe 10 people there who actually know where it is, and then most of those are in the Pentagon. So it really hasn't been something that's been pushed by the U.S. government in any way. Well, having said that, the U.S. ambassador has played a very critical role in the past few weeks, and he's been very good at criticizing Akayev, criticizing the fraudulent elections, and pressing for an investigation into those elections.
Who's the opposition?
Sorry, the?
Opposition.
Well, the opposition from within the U.S. or
no, the opposition there. Who did he beat? Or who did he rig the elections against?
The opposition's very divided. It's a whole mix of different people. They do seem to be coming together in the past few days, and I hope that they can map out a program to hold elections. There's no critical figure in the way that there was in Georgia or in Ukraine, so it's very much up in the air who's going to emerge as the leader.
Uzbekistan. Tell us about Uzbekistan and the U.S. role there, and then how that relates to Kyrgyzstan.
Well, Uzbekistan is simply one of the worst police states on earth. I mean, this is a country where you can be arrested for going to a mosque, for having a beard, for any sort of religious activity that strays out of the state's definition of what it is to be a Muslim. It's a place where people get boiled to death in prisons. And yet this is a place that the U.S. government has a very close relationship with. There are military bases in Uzbekistan. And Karimov, the dictator there, has had a fairly close relationship with the Bush administration. There's a lot of frustration in Washington as well about his failure to reform, his failure to open up the country economically, and the declining social situation there.
It's certainly not one of the countries that President Bush mentions when he talks about the spread of democracy or opening up in the Middle East.
It isn't at all. And yet, even groups like Freedom House and whatever rank it in the same level as North Korea in terms of its complete absence of freedom and human rights then.
But it has a military base, a U.S. military base.
It does have a major base that services the operations in Afghanistan.
And how does Uzbekistan relate to Kyrgyzstan next door?
Well, they both occupy large areas of the Fergana Valley in the south, and there's a real concern that Uzbekistan might intervene in southern Kyrgyzstan if the situation there disintegrates. The town of Osh, which is a major bazaar town in the south of Kyrgyzstan, has been much more chaotic than Bishkek, and there are certainly Islamic groups vying for power there. There are criminal groups that have been operating there. And in this situation, there's a real worry that you may see a recurrence of some of the ethnic violence that was directed against ethnic Uzbeks. If that happens, Uzbekistan might take the opportunity to intervene. And I think people will be working very hard to make sure that Uzbekistan stays out of the situation in Kyrgyzstan.
And what about the living conditions of the people in Kyrgyzstan? Clearly in Russia, there has been a huge deterioration in living standards of many Russians since the collapse of the Soviet Union. What is happening in Kyrgyzstan?
Well, they have declined very seriously. They're better than they are in a number of other neighboring countries. They're probably better than they are in Uzbekistan now and better than Tajikistan. But still, they have declined very markedly in the past 15 years. A lot of Kyrgyz are going to Kazakhstan and to Russia for migrant work. There's a huge array of poverty, very difficult to find jobs, particular problems in the south where pretty much all of the industry in the Fergana Valley was wiped out. So very severe problems in terms of the economy.
And is there any major investment, a foreign investment, or U.S. investment in Kyrgyzstan, any major resources that Western nations might covet?
There's quite a lot of gold, and there are a number of major gold mines there which have been very much linked to the Akayev family. They're mostly run by Canadian companies rather than U.S. companies, but gold is probably the most significant resource. Kyrgyzstan also provides most of the water for the rest of Central Asia, and that's a critical resource that it could make more money from.
We want to thank you very much, Robert Templer, Director of the Asia Program for the International Crisis Group, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And you are watching and listening to Democracy Now! As we continue coming back to this country to a major victory for students and workers in Washington, D.C. Juan?
Well, after a three-year campaign, students at Georgetown University have won their fight to secure living wages for university workers. The campaign, known as Georgetown Living Wage Coalition, culminated in a nine-day hunger strike by over 20 students. Two students were hospitalized in the action.
On Thursday, the university accepted almost all the campaign's 10 demands. The minimum wage for campus employees will be raised to a living wage of $15 an hour. Currently, some subcontractors are earning less than $9 an hour. In recent days, the students attracted support from D.C. labor and religious communities. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney released a statement applauding the hunger strike campaign, and some faculty members have shown support. We're joined now in Washington, D.C. by Mike Wilson, a senior at Georgetown University, majoring in justice and peace studies, part of the Georgetown Living Wage Coalition. He was on the hunger strike for 5 days. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about this campaign? Can you talk about what you did and how you won?
Yeah, well, we began about 3 years ago. We had been a group that had mainly worked on global sweatshop issues. And we had started looking at the situation of workers on campus because we had gotten Georgetown to join a group called the Workers' Rights Consortium that was independently monitoring factories where Georgetown apparel was made. So we started speaking to workers on campus to see what the labor conditions were like there. We started to learn how little workers at Georgetown made. People at the time were making as little as $6.15 an hour, which was the D.C. minimum wage at the time. So we started to talk to them about what we could do about it and start to have conversations among ourselves. The first thing we began doing was providing volunteer English as a second language classes for a lot of the mainly Spanish-speaking workers. We started providing worker appreciation breakfasts on Friday mornings. And then we started talking to our administration about what we could do to improve the working conditions at Georgetown and raise the wages. The first reaction from the administration was to just put us into a committee process that seemed to be endless. We released a report 2 years ago about the conditions at Georgetown that included the 10 demands that we'd been asking for since then. What basically happened was about a week and a half ago, we had set a deadline for the latest committee we had been a part of to commit to a policy that we could all agree on, and they refused to do so. The committee that we had been working with continued to refuse to make decisions throughout the entire process. So we decided to start the hunger strike campaign to help the university understand the urgency of the situation. We felt that they weren't understanding the urgency of the situation when it was just the workers' lives that we were talking about. So we felt like we had to put our own lives and our own health at stake to make the university understand the urgency.
And you appear to have won not only a commitment around the wages, but around several other issues as well. You were pushing for the university to remain absolutely neutral in terms of the possibility of unions of the workers being able to unionize. You had demands about their job security. What was the total package of issues that you were able to be successful on?
Well, yeah, what the university originally was focusing on was the wage and how much it would cost and things like that. But we were trying to push the idea that this policy had to be more than just about the wage. It had to be about a new way of looking at employment at Georgetown. So we were asking Georgetown to commit to prioritizing full-time employment. We didn't want Georgetown to be able to just start hiring people part-time to do work that could be done as full-time and keeping members of the community and making sure that they were getting paid these wages and having these benefits. One of the big issues was the union issue. We wanted Georgetown to commit itself and its contractors to a policy of neutrality in union campaigns because we felt that this wage was important and our fighting for it with the workers at Georgetown was important. But we wanted the workers themselves to feel empowered so that they could continue this fight after those of us who've been working on this campaign graduate and leave. We wanted the workers to keep the power. And so we had been demanding this, especially since Marriott Corporation is one of the contractors at Georgetown. They provide food service for us, and we wanted to ensure that workers from Marriott, which is one of the biggest union busing companies in the country, would be holding Marriott to this policy of neutrality. Other things we were asking for was ensuring that Georgetown wouldn't just cut these contracts, lose all the workers we had been working with, and start directly hiring totally different people. So one of the demands we were also asking for was to ensure that if things like that were to happen, Georgetown would prioritize the work of the contractors. We also wanted to ensure that all the contract workers had access to the same kinds of benefits that the full-time workers have, such as like access to university-sponsored English as a second language programs, like transportation shuttles, the library, classes, things like that. So there were a lot of like non-wage benefits that we were asking for that for the first 2 years of the campaign, the university just didn't even want to address.
And what about the organized labor? John Sweeney came out obviously in support of you, but did you receive cooperation and support from the unions in the city throughout the campaign, or did it come later on, or what?
Well, yeah, we had been keeping them updated on what we had been doing throughout the campaign. They were very helpful in terms of resources and support. When we started the hunger strike, when we decided we needed to take that step, we met with the Metro Labor Council President Joss Williams here in D.C. and talked to him about ways that they could provide help. One of the best actions that we did during the campaign was This Tuesday, we had one of our biggest rally in Red Square, which is in the center of campus. We had Joss Williams and Eleanor Holmes Norton and Richard Trumka from the AFL-CIO speak, and they were able to turn out a whole bunch of union members, which we then led a march to the administration building and sort of took over the lobby to the president's office for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and tried to get the president to meet with some of the union officials. And when he wouldn't, the union officials came out and said that they would start a solidarity fast with us on Thursday morning if the university hadn't agreed to this proposal by Wednesday night. And the university came out with the proposal that we eventually agreed to at 11:30 on Wednesday night. So we think that they were very influential and very helpful in this campaign.
Mike Wilson, want to thank you very much for joining us, majoring in Justice and Peace Studies at Georgetown University. I was one of those who fought to ensure that workers have a living wage. This week marks the number of anniversaries of significant political events. March 24th was the 25th anniversary of the killing of Archbishop Oscar Romero in El Salvador by graduates of the U.S. Army School of the Americas. It was also the 6th anniversary of the beginning of the 78-day U.S. bombing of Serbia in 1999. And 40 years ago, March 24th, 1965, the first ever teach-in was held against the Vietnam War. It took place on the campus of the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. To mark the anniversary, teach-ins against the occupation of Iraq were held all over the country yesterday. Naomi Klein spoke at the one in Washington, D.C. There was one in San Francisco, another in Ann Arbor, where we broadcast from last week. And if you'd like to go to our website at democracynow.org, you can listen there to or watch an interview with one of the original participants in that teach-in 40 years ago in University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Well, as we wrap up this weekend, I thought it would be important just to talk about Democracy Now! Starting our 50-city Unembed the Media tour. We'll be beginning on Monday right here in New York. Monday morning, we'll be joined on the show by Camilo Mejia, who is the Florida Army National Guardsman who fought in Iraq, came back, and refused to return. He is the first U.S. soldier in Iraq to be court-martialed for resisting, has just come out of prison after a year. He'll be joining us on Monday morning on the broadcast, and then on Monday night, he'll be joining us for the kickoff of the Unembed the Media Tour at the Ethical Culture Society here in New York. We'll also be joined by Phil Donahue, who joined us yesterday on the show. Phil Donahue was fired by MSNBC for presenting a forum on his MSNBC show before the invasion for anti-war voices. Juan will also be with us, Juan Gonzalez, Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Producer, and WBAI's Bernard White will be hosting the event. That'll be Monday night, Ethical Culture Society. And if you want to get tickets, you can get them at our website at democracynow.org, or you can call us here at 212-431-9090. Camilla, Juan, Phil Donahue will also be joining us for a reception before at 6 o'clock at the Ethical Culture Society. On Tuesday, we head to Houston to celebrate KPFT. The Monday benefit is for WBAI. Tuesday for Houston Station KPFT at the River Oaks Theater. On Wednesday in Washington, we'll be at All Souls Church in Washington, D.C., celebrating WPFW. And Thursday in Los Angeles with KPFK at the Emmanuel Baptist Church. On Friday, we'll be in San Francisco. That does it for our show. All the details will be on our website, democracynow.org. Saturday, Portland, Oregon, and then Seattle, Washington. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Yoruba Richin also produced today's program. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.